From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Yeah, this is a big price tag because it's a big problem, Mike. I told our people I don't want to be timid in the face of a significant problem that'll affect the average citizen.
The Bush administration asked Congress to approve a $700 billion package to rescue Wall Street. It's being described as the largest government bailout of private markets in U.S. history. We'll get analysis and speak with independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. Then we'll go to the Wall Street Journal's former senior Baghdad correspondent, Barnaz Fasihi, on Waiting for an Ordinary Day, the unraveling of life in Iraq. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Treasury Department has formally asked Congress to approve a $700 billion bailout of the financial industry and to create a government fund to buy illiquid assets from the nation's banks. The Bush administration proposal could be the largest government bailout of private industry in the nation's history. Some analysts say the final cost to taxpayers could top $1 trillion over the week, and the size of the proposed bailout grew as the Bush administration said foreign banks, including Barclays and UBS, should be eligible for the bailout. The Financial Times reports some industry groups are lobbying for the fund to grow ever larger by including a clause that would allow banks to account for any losses realized over a number of years. President Bush defended the proposal on Friday.
Our system of free enterprise rests on the conviction that the federal government should interfere in the marketplace only when necessary. Given the precarious state of today's financial markets and their vital importance to the daily lives of the American people, government intervention is not only warranted, it is essential.
The Democratic leadership in Congress appears to back the bailout, but are pushing to include provisions to protect homeowners, place constraints on excessive executive compensation, and to provide independent oversight of the fund. Under the Bush administration's proposal, there would be no restrictions on the administration other than requiring semiannual reports to Congress. This would grant the Treasury Secretary unprecedented power to buy and resell mortgage debt. Meanwhile, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson is opposing plans to help homeowners face foreclosure as part of the bailout. Paulson said Congress should approve a so-called clean bill.
The ultimate taxpayer protection will be the stability this troubled asset relief program provides to our financial system, even as it will involve a significant investment of taxpayer dollars. I am convinced that this bold approach will cost American families far less than the alternative. A continuing series of financial institution failures and frozen credit markets unable to fund economic expansion.
Meanwhile, the era of investment banks appears to have ended. Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, the last big independent investment banks on Wall Street, are transforming themselves into bank holding companies subject to far greater regulation. On the campaign trail, Senator Barack Obama criticized John McCain for his support of privately investing Social Security money in the same markets that tanked last weekend.
I know Senator McCain is talking about a casino culture on Wall Street, but the fact is, he's the one who wants to gamble with your life savings, and that is not going to happen when I'm president of the United States. When I'm president, we're not going to gamble with Social Security. We're not going to gamble with your ability to retire with dignity after a lifetime of hard work. We're going to strengthen and protect Social Security so it's a safety net our families can count on today, tomorrow, and always.
Meanwhile, John McCain defended his support of deregulating the financial industry. He was asked about his views last night on 60 Minutes.
In 1999, you were one of the senators who helped pass deregulation of Wall Street. Do you regret that now?
No, I think the deregulation was probably helpful to the growth of our economy.
We'll have more on the financial crisis after headlines. In South Africa, Thabo Mbeki announced Sunday he is resigning as president of South Africa following allegations he interfered in a corruption case against political rival and current African National Congress leader Jacob Zuma. On Saturday, the executive committee of the ANC demanded Mbeki step down for meddling in the case against Zuma. Mbeki said he is agreeing to resign but denied the charges against him.
I've been a loyal member of the African National Congress for 52 years. I remain a member of the ANC and therefore respect its decisions. It is for this reason that I've taken the decision to resign as President of the Republic, following the decision of the National Executive Committee of the ANC.
In 1997, Mbeki succeeded Nelson Mandela to become South Africa's second post-apartheid president. In Pakistan, at least 53 people died Saturday after a massive explosion devastated the Marriott Hotel in Pakistan's capital, Islamabad. Over 250 people were wounded. The explosion occurred when a truck packed with 1,300 pounds of explosives rammed into the hotel. About a dozen foreigners were killed in the blast, including the Czech ambassador and two Pentagon employees. Officials say Pakistan's president, prime minister, and military chiefs were supposed to have been holding a meeting in the hotel at the time, but they changed the venue of the meeting at the last minute. The attack is seen by many as a warning from Islamist militants over the Pakistani government's cooperation with the United States. On Tuesday, Pakistan's new president, Asif Ali Zardari, is scheduled to meet with President Bush. Former President Jimmy Carter has called on the Georgia State Board of Pardons and Paroles to reverse its decision to deny clemency to Troy Davis, who's scheduled to be executed tomorrow on Tuesday. Since Davis was convicted of allegedly killing a police officer in 1991, seven of the nine non-police witnesses have recanted. No physical or DNA evidence ties Davis to the crime. Jimmy Carter said, quote, "This case illustrates the deep flaws in the application of the death penalty in this country. Executing Troy Davis without a real examination of potentially exonerating evidence risks taking the life of an innocent man and would be a grave miscarriage of justice," Jimmy Carter said. In Atlanta, Georgians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty and the NAACP are planning to hold a rally today in front of the state capitol. Georgia's planning to execute Davis on Tuesday, even though the U.S. Supreme Court is scheduled to decide next week on whether to hear a last-minute appeal in his case. A new study out of UCLA has concluded ethnic violence, not the Bush administration's surge, was the primary factor in reducing violence in Iraq. The UCLA geographers studied how much light was being generated at night in different neighborhoods of Baghdad. Nightlight in neighborhoods populated primarily by embattled Sunni residents declined dramatically just before the February 2007 surge and never returned. Meanwhile, the use of lights at night remained constant or increased during the surge in largely Shia neighborhoods. Co-author Thomas Gillespie said, quote, "If the surge had truly worked, we would expect to see a steady increase in nightlight output over time. Instead, we found the nightlight signature diminished in only certain neighborhoods, and the pattern appears to be associated with ethno-sectarian violence and neighborhood ethnic cleansing." The city of St. Paul has announced charges will be dropped against journalists who were arrested during the Republican National Convention protests and cited with unlawful assembly. St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman said Friday the city attorney's office recommended against prosecuting reporters for the misdemeanor charge. Over 40 journalists were arrested or detained during the Republican convention, including three of us at Democracy Now!, myself and producer Sharif Abdelkaddous and Nicole Salazar. Beginning in October, the Army plans to station an active unit inside the United States for the first time to serve as an on-call federal response in times of emergency. The 3rd Infantry Division's 1st Brigade Combat Team has spent 35 of the last 60 months in Iraq, but now the unit's training for domestic operations. The unit will soon be under the day-to-day control of U.S. Army North, the Army service component of Northern Command. The Army Times reports this new mission marks the first time an active unit has been given a dedicated assignment to Northern Command. The paper says the Army unit may be called upon to help with civil unrest and crowd control. The soldiers are learning to use so-called non-lethal weapons designed to subdue unruly or dangerous individuals and crowds. Federal agents have arrested at least 200 people in immigration raids in Illinois, Indiana, Colorado, and California over the past week. Most of the arrests took place in the Chicago area and northern Indiana. Beginning on September 12th, four ICE fugitive operation teams detained and arrested 144 people. 59 more immigrants were arrested in Colorado, where agents conducted raids in 14 cities. In California, agents arrested 21 undocumented immigrants working at a chain of Chinese restaurants. Meanwhile, a new study by the Pew Hispanic Center has found nearly 1 in 10 Latinos in the United States reported in the last year police or other authorities stopped them and asked them about their immigration status. Last year, ICE agents arrested more than 35,000 undocumented immigrants, more than double the number in 2006. In Vermont, the Progressive Party candidate for state attorney general says she plans to prosecute President Bush for murder if she's elected. Charlotte Dennett made the announcement alongside the famed prosecutor Vincent Bugliosi, who recently wrote the book The Prosecution of George W. Bush for Murder. Bugliosi said any state attorney general or local district attorney can bring criminal charges against Bush once he leaves office early next year. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers around the country and around the world. It's being described as the largest government intervention in private markets since the Great Depression. The Bush administration has asked Congress to swiftly approve a massive $700 billion package to rescue the crippled financial institutions on Wall Street. But congressional Democrats have begun to draw up their conditions for the proposed bailout bill. Their terms include limits on the salaries and severance packages of executives at firms participating in the bailout. They also call for increased assistance to distressed homeowners across the country and greater congressional oversight of the Treasury Department. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi warned against giving Wall Street a $700 billion blank check. The bailout plan was drawn up by Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and would set up a fund that uses taxpayer money to buy out the bad debt on Wall Street. The plan would also give nearly unlimited powers to the Treasury Secretary. Meanwhile, the last two major investment banks, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley, have changed their status from investment banking from investment banks to bank holding companies. This change, approved by the Federal Reserve Sunday, allows them to create commercial banks and also gives them access to the Fed's emergency loans.
Speaking on NBC's Meet the Press Sunday, Paulson admitted he was humbled by the crisis, but added Americans would, quote, work through this.
Well, what I would say is I won't bet against the American people. We're an entrepreneurial people, a hardworking people, and we will work through this. We always do. I wouldn't bet against the American people, and I wouldn't bet against the long-term fundamentals of this country. But this is a humbling experience to see so much fragility in our capital markets and to ask, how did we ever get here?
President Bush defended the Treasury's rescue plan Saturday, arguing it shielded, quote, average citizens from the crisis.
Yeah, this is a big price tag because it's a big problem, Mike. I told our people I don't want to be timid in the face of a significant problem that'll affect the average citizen. You know, some said, well, this is, we could contain this to just the financial community. In my judgment, based upon the advice of a lot of people who know how markets work, this wasn't going to be contained to just the financial community. This problem would spread to the average citizen. You know, you hear them talking about Wall Street and Main Street. Well, this is Wall Street plus Main Street, and I'm worried about Main Street.
The Democratic and Republican presidential nominees also addressed the financial meltdown from the campaign trail. On Friday, Senator Obama said he supported efforts by the Treasury and the Federal Reserve to work out a rescue package.
Today, I fully support the efforts of Secretary Paulson and Federal Reserve Chairman Bernanke to work in a bipartisan spirit with Congress to find a solution of this sort. What we're looking at right now is to provide the Treasury and the Federal Reserve with as broad authority as is necessary to stabilize markets and to maintain credit.
Meanwhile, Senator McCain promised supporters in Green Bay, Wisconsin Friday he would bring changes to help regulate Wall Street.
To deal with the immediate crisis, I will lead in the creation of the Mortgage and Financial Institutions Trust, the MFI. The underlying principle of the MFI, or any approach considered by Congress, should be to keep people in their homes and safeguard the life savings of all Americans by protecting our financial system and capital markets.
In a moment, we'll be joined by one of the senators who will be voting on the legislation, the independent senator of Vermont, Bernie Sanders. But we turn now to two other guests. Dean Baker is an economist and co-director of the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Economic and Policy Research, frequent contributor and columnist. His blog is Beat the Press. He's the author of several books, including The United States Since 1980 and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He joins us from Washington, D.C. And we're joined by Robert Scheer in Los Angeles, California, veteran journalist, syndicated columnist at San Francisco Chronicle, editor of the political website Truthdig. He's the author of several books, most recently The Pornography of Power, How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America. Dean Baker, let's start with you. Explain the legislation that is being introduced.
Well, essentially what the president's asked for is a $700 billion blank check. He wants Congress to hand over $700 billion to Henry Paulson to use to buy, you know, bad, originally mortgage-backed securities. There's apparently an effort by the financial community to broaden that, but basically he would have a blank check to bail out Wall Street. And let me just make one point that everyone should be very, very clear on. This was not an accident in the sense that this is like a hurricane. This was a totally predictable event. So when President Bush or Henry Paulson say, you know, we have to come to the rescue, it is because of their incompetence, because people who understood the economy, I'm putting myself among those, but there are others, we were warning about this a long, long time ago. This was a totally predictable event that brought us here.
And Dean Baker, in terms of the of what it would cover, even the White House apparently keeps changing it. By late Saturday night, they were talking also about the possibility of bailing out foreign banks that had invested in instruments in the United States, as well as moving beyond just securities backed by home mortgage loans, but also to other types of debt as well.
Absolutely. And this speaks to the nature of the bailout. The bailout should not be fun if it's constructed right. The way this should be constructed is, if you're on the edge of bankruptcy, you come to the Treasury and you get the money. But guess what? You're selling your company. And you also have serious limits on CEO pay. You know, you only get $2 million a year. How's that? Or maybe less. You know, some people propose less than that. But the bailout has to be punitive if it's serious. It shouldn't be a field day. We shouldn't have people lining up to get in. That's telling us that this is not a serious bailout. So the idea that the administration proposing is that the people who were engaged in incredibly reckless behavior, who made out like bandits, getting tens of millions of dollars in salary and compensation over the last few years, are now going to get this $700 billion blank check from the American taxpayer. It's just unbelievable.
Robert Scheer, I'd like you to weigh in here. Actually, when hearing Henry Paulson questioned by George Stephanopoulos on ABC yesterday, the Treasury Secretary said, we don't want this to be punitive. We've got to basically save the country, he said.
Well, you know, in the clips you play, these people just lied through their teeth. I mean, Bush, who after all knows about the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, because
we're going to have to, Robert, we're going to have to fix your sound. I'll put that question to Dean Baker while we correct that, Dean.
Yeah, well, as I said, this is really just an incredible. We want it to be punitive. If Henry Paulson doesn't want it to be punitive, that's telling us, from the word go, he is not the guy to run this. This is not supposed to be a giveaway. You know, these are the richest people in the whole country. And if it's not punitive, what we're telling them is just, you know, go out, run your banks in a reckless manner, because that's what they did. They wouldn't be here if they didn't run their banks in a reckless manner. Pay yourself 30, 40, 50 million a year in compensation. Then when you get in trouble, go running to the government and we'll just hand you hundreds of billions of more. If this isn't punitive, if this isn't really painful, for them to come to the government, then we've messed up with the bailout. They don't have to do it. Again, you know, if your business is good, if you could get by without the bailout, wonderful. Don't come talk to us. You don't need the money. But if you're going to get a handout, it's going to be punitive. That's the way it's supposed to be.
And what were some of the major mistakes or flaws in how these investment companies and banks dealt with this crisis? Back now, because we've been knowing that this has been building in the heartland now for a couple of years.
Well, we've been knowing it since 6 years. The basic story was we had a housing bubble, which, again, these people are supposed to be smart. They're paid tens of millions of dollars. They should have recognized the housing bubble. They should have recognized that house prices would fall as they have been. And what that meant was you made a loan on a house for $250,000, $300,000, $400,000. That house price was likely to fall. So if you did that with zero down, as many of them did, plus having mortgages, you know, the predatory mortgages, the subprime mortgages that have got them in particular trouble, these were guaranteed to go bad in many cases. They acted as though house prices would just keep going up forever and they could just keep, you know, going along these lines. They leveraged themselves to the hilt. The investment banks like Lehman and Bear Stearns leveraged themselves to ratio 30 to 1. In other words, if they had $10 billion in capital, they had loans on the order of $300 billion. I mean, this was just asking for disaster. And, you know, again, it did collapse. It was totally predictable it would collapse. You know, I didn't know when, didn't know exactly who, but it was totally predictable. And now they're running to us and asking us for handouts. Think of what we do to welfare people when they, you know, everything they have to go through to get, you know, $500 a month check. And these people want billions, no questions asked. Unbelievable.
Robert Scheer, let's try again in Los Angeles. Your analysis is what has happened. And if you could bring into the history of what took place, those words we almost never hear on television, Glass-Steagall.
Hello?
Hi, can you hear us?
Can they hear me?
Yeah, we hear you just fine. Well, we're going to go to a break. We'll fix this problem, and we'll come right back. Robert Scheer, veteran journalist, also with us. Dean Baker, who is director of the Washington, D.C.-based Center for Economic and Policy Research. We'll be back in a minute. Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our guest Dean Baker, economist at Center for Economic and Policy Research. His blog is Beat the Press, and Robert Scheer, longtime journalist, columnist, and editor at the political website Truthdig. Robert Scheer, go through the past and also talk about Glass-Steagall.
Yeah, well, the point is when Bush and McCain and Paulson, who was head of Goldman Sachs before he was head of the Treasury, say they don't know how this happened, they designed the system. We had a regulatory regime in place ever since the Great Depression to prevent this kind of meltdown, and that said that stockbrokers, insurance companies, banks, and investment banks, commercial banks could not merge. And in 1999, they passed legislation, the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act. Graham is the guy who McCain supported for president in 96. He was co-chair of his campaign until he complained about the whiners out there, meaning the public. And that legislation is what caused this. It allowed the swaps and everything else. And then in 2000, hours before the Christmas break, Graham introduced legislation. I'm holding it in my hand. This smoking gun is available on the internet. You can read it. And what it said is that the swaps is defined in the Financial Service Modernization Act, meaning that instead of going into a bank and somebody said, okay, we'll give you a loan and we expect you to pay it over 30 years. We know your house has the equity. We know you have the means to pay it. That was the traditional way. Instead, they allowed these mergers mergers, and as a result, they could buy insurance on it, they could do these swaps, they could do what they call hybrid instruments. And in this legislation that was never discussed, was never in, had hearings or anything, says that all of this stuff is exempted from all previous regulation. The SEC cannot regulate it, the Commodity Futures Board cannot regulate it. So they gave these institutions, of which Goldman Sachs was critical, so was Citigroup, where Robert Rubin, who was Clinton's Treasury Secretary, he had also come from Goldman Sachs. And by the way, even though this is Republican-led, there were plenty of Democrats, in fact, a majority of Democrats, who voted for this, and Robert Rubin, who unfortunately is advising Barack Obama. I don't know how this guy can wake up and, you know, and not be embarrassed at how he can appear on television. And Lawrence Summers, these are the two guys in the Clinton administration who teamed up with Phil Graham to pass that atrocious legislation. And now, you know, it seems to me, in terms of the bailout, why don't they do what Hillary Clinton said during the primaries, just put a freeze on foreclosures? Start out with helping the homeowners and say, okay, we're not going to foreclose your house for the next year. We're going to force the banks to work out reasonable payments. We'll try to help you hold on to it. That would have stopped the bleeding here much more effectively than throwing $700 billion at these bandits.
Bob Scheer, the issue also of this rush to pass this legislation. I'm reminded somewhat of the Patriot Act after 9/11. An immense tragedy occurs, and immediately they try to rush through legislation without many of the members of Congress even having a handle as to what it really contains.
Oh, it's absolutely outrageous, and we can't let him get away with it. I mean, consider that Paulson was the head of Goldman Sachs, okay? He knew about credit swaps. He knew about hybrid instruments. He knew all of this stuff. And now he's the guy that says Congress has to give him a blank check. It has to be a pure bill. Nonsense. This is our money. Why isn't this money used to help people who are going to lose their houses? You miss two, three payments, and they're going to foreclose on you. Then they say, well, we hope the banks will work out new agreements. Nonsense. Do a freeze on foreclosures, stop the bleeding, have a year to let it settle, and force the banks to come to agreements. You know, but I mean, the idea that they didn't know what was going on, this was a Ponzi scheme of their creation, and they thought they would bail before it hit the fan. That's what they thought. They'd be gone, and someone else would be blamed. They'd have their golden parachutes. I don't know why we're not considering criminal charges against these people. They have done more to hurt this nation than Bin Laden could ever dream of.
Well, Robert Scheer, we're also joined on the telephone by Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent of Vermont, elected to the Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House, longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history. Senator Sanders says the middle class shouldn't be forced to pay for a crisis created by what he calls the Bush administration's deregulatory fever and Wall Street's insatiable greed. Senator Sanders, welcome to Democracy Now! Well, the watchword these days is—or words, I should say—too big to fail.
Well, Amy, that's right. And I think if it's too big to fail, it probably is too big to exist. And by the way, among many other things, what we're doing now with the Bank of America picking up Countrywide and picking up Merrill Lynch, you're creating another institution which is too big to fail. So that, among many other things, in my view, that we've got to do is to start breaking up these very, very large multinational corporations who continuously put us in this position. But my main concern, I've only got a few minutes here, my main concern is twofold. I mean, for the longest period of time, up to literally a few weeks ago, we had our friends in the Bush administration telling us that the fundamentals of the economy are strong. Everything is just fine. And now they tell us we're on the verge of a major economic meltdown. We've got to give Wall Street a $700 billion bailout. And by the way, of course, it is not going to be the people who have benefited, the people at the very, very top who have benefited financially from Bush's reckless economic policies, who are going to pick up the bailout. It is going to be the middle class, which has been suffering for the last 8 years. So the first point that we have to make is, if a bailout is necessary, it is not going to be, if I have anything to say about it, working people picking up the cost of this. It is going to be the top 0.1% who earn more than the bottom 50%. It is going to be all of these people who have made out very, very well under Bush's reckless policies. So that's my main concern right now. Obviously, also we have to ensure that the assets purchased from the banks are realistically discounted so that we don't get ripped off in the process. And we have to require that taxpayers receive equity stakes in the bailed out companies. Also, I think that we on the left have got to be thinking big and learn a little bit from our right-wing friends who are able to pivot on a dime. For years now, they've told us that we can't afford, that government providing health care to all people is just unimaginable. It can't be done. We don't have the money to rebuild our infrastructure. We don't have the money to wipe out poverty. We can't do it all. But all of a sudden, yeah, we do have $700 billion for a bailout of Wall Street. So my view is that included in what we do, there should be a significant stimulus package, a really significant one, which addresses health care, which addresses sustainable energy, which addresses the infrastructure, which creates a substantial number of jobs, addressing many of the long-term unmet needs of this country. Obviously, also, we got to understand why we got into this business. I was just rereading a speech that I gave in the House. I was on the House Banking Committee in 1999 when Glass-Steagall legislation was done away with, and the walls were broken down. And I think many of the things that I said and a number of other people said at that time about what would happen, in fact, has happened. So you got to go back to re-regulating not only financial services, but you've also got to look at energy trading as well, which is certainly one of the reasons that people are paying $3.70 for a gallon of gas today. So I think those are some of the directions that we've got to move in the next few weeks.
Senator Sanders, are you concerned that among the Democrats, and especially in the Barack Obama, that many of the advisors and people helping them to shape the policies were involved in the original deregulation process itself?
Well, I think that people like Bob Rubin and people like Larry Summers come from a wing of the party, the corporate wing of the party, which has done major disservice to the people of this country. And I think Barack and I think the Democratic leadership have got to pick up economic advisors who are going to reject this nonsense of more tax breaks for billionaires, unfettered free trade, deregulation, and that whole parcel of right-wing ideology, which has done us so much harm.
Senator Bernie Sanders, when you say you want this included in this bill, that, well, Paulson says he wants a clean bill, what do you mean when you add health care and sustainable energy?
I mean, if we're going to be bailing out people at the top who have done this country so much harm, obviously part of the package is to understand that we have millions of kids in this country who have no health insurance, 46 million without health insurance, that we have major 6% unemployment, an infrastructure which is crumbling, that we have the opportunity now to begin the process of rebuilding America and putting people to work. So clearly, as part of a package, there should be a major effort to create good-paying jobs, meeting the unmet needs that Bush has allowed to exist for so many years.
And this issue of the Bush administration wanting to also extend the bailout to foreign banks, whether they be Japanese, Korean, or investors in other parts of the world, wouldn't this explode the actual cost of this bailout even beyond $700 billion?
That's right. There are some people, and I'm not going to tell you that I'm an expert on all of this stuff, because I'm really not. But there are some people who think that, in fact, the amount of money that these guys are talking about is not right, that it'll end up being more than $700 billion. And the other part, of course, which is not acceptable, is that they want to give the Secretary of the Treasury almost unprecedented power in the United States with no transparency, just to do essentially what he wants to do. And we won't learn about the kind of deals that he has developed until long after the process ends.
And the climate in your House and the Senate right now, Senator Sanders, what do you think is going to happen? Well, you have this enormous rush.
I don't know. I have not been, to tell you the truth, overly happy by some of the responses that I'm hearing. I think we have to start off with the premise that the Bush administration has been the most incompetent administration, certainly in modern history. They've been incredibly dishonest. They've been very political. And I think if anyone forgets about the fact that there's an election in 6 weeks, I think one would be very, very naive. So I think the Democrats have got to stand very tall. And I think on everything that I've told you about who should
payout, pay for this bailout, I think you're going to have overwhelming support from the American people. The American people understand that under Bush, they have been ripped off. Their standard of living is declining, while the people on top have made out like bandits. And now is the time to say, sorry, we're not going to pick up. We're not going to pick up the damage done by these folks.
Senator Sanders, what does this mean for the presidential race? How is this political?
Well, they're going to be, believe me, they're going to be spinning every other minute. Right now, as you know, John McCain, who is I hope all listeners know, is very close to Phil Gramm. And one can argue that Phil Gramm was the leading exponent. He was the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, the leading exponent of deregulation. He is the guy who got the so-called Enron loophole through. He is the guy who certainly led the effort for deregulation in financial services. He was McCain's key economic advisor, and there was some talk that he'd be Secretary of the Treasury under a McCain administration. Now, of course, that was yesterday, and now we find McCain, the great trust buster, the great fighter for regulation, the guy who's going to take on Wall Street. And that's what Karl Rove and the Republicans do very well. They assume that the American people don't remember yesterday, and you just start off, you know, with today. I hope that the Democrats do a good job in exposing that. I think Obama is getting that word out. I think the message for this campaign is that we have had 8 years of right-wing extremist ideology. We have given incredible tax breaks to the very wealthiest people who don't need it. We have worked aggressively, and Bush and McCain are working on it today, for unfettered free trade, which has meant the loss of millions of good-paying jobs. We have done an enormous amount of deregulation so that you can end up in the situation we're in today. And that's obviously McCain's philosophy. And if the American people understand that, and they understand what a disaster Bush's policies have been, it would seem to me that Obama should win with a very comfortable vote.
One of the other things that the administration has done is it's now extending insurance to money market funds of Wall Street firms, especially in retirement accounts, when previously the government was only insuring bank deposits. Do you support this as well?
Well, do I support what the Bush administration is proposing? No, I don't. There's going to be a lot of work that has to be done in a very short while. I am certainly not going to be supporting anything close to what the Bush administration has brought down. Amy, with that, I'm afraid I'm going to have to run.
Well, I thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Independent Senator of Vermont, Bernie Sanders, will be one of those voting on this legislation. Robert Scheer, I want to go back to you. What does this mean for the future of American capitalism?
Well, I think Senator Sanders made a very important point. You know, Barack Obama, back in March at Cooper Union, Robert Rubin, who's now unfortunately close to the campaign, in January of this year, he's the guy who in the Clinton administration pushed through the Financial Services Modernization Act, allowing this madness. But in January, he said, we don't have a problem. This is just a normal fluctuation of the market. That was in a speech he gave at Cooper Union. However, in March, Barack Obama gave a very good speech on the economy. He said much of what we have been saying on the show so far. Unfortunately, he lost that voice temporarily, and these people like Summers and Rubin moved over to his campaign. So I think the, if Barack Obama can recover his populist voice that got him where he so far in the primaries, I think this should be a runaway. I mean, it's unbelievable that the American people would want 4 more years of this madness. I would point out, you've asked a question about covering foreign banks. One of those foreign banks, UBS Swiss Base, is where Phil Gramm works. He was rewarded after being head of the banking committee, pushing through this deregulation. His wife, Wendy Gramm, went to work for Enron, was on their audit committee. She's runs a big institute for deregulation that the big corporations put a lot of money into. Phil Gramm went to work for UBS, a foreign-based banking conglomerate, and now they want to extend this coverage to those banks. These people have no shame. I think it's time, as I said before, to really talk about criminal investigation. They have defrauded the American people, and they changed the laws. You know, the old folk song, Woody Guthrie, I guess, you know, some will rob you with a gun and others with a fountain pen. I mean, imagine these people came in, rewrote federal regulation to exempt the kind of credit swaps. I know this people find this a bit confusing, but I'm saying they got to read up on it. The hybrid instruments that they talk about, that's what allowed all of this. That's why AIG got in trouble. They're supposed to be selling insurance. They're not supposed to be backing security packages. And all of this stuff was hidden. It was murky. The bankers themselves admit they don't know what was going on. And all of that was made legal. It was illegal up until, you know, less than 10 years ago. It was made legal by acts of Congress led by the Republicans. And unfortunately, a majority of Democrats backed it. And Bill Clinton signed off on that first major legislation. So we have to be very wary. Yeah.
Well, Bob Scheer, the amazing irony now is, as we read in some of the papers today, that the very firms that were involved in creating this crisis are now lining up in Washington to be able to become managers in case the federal government buys up this debt, and then it needs to manage how it will get rid of the debt, so that the very firms are now lining up to become the money managers of the distressed debt that the government buys.
Right. What you've got here is really the end of the Reagan Revolution. And I hate to bring up the bad F word, but, you know, there is a model for this, and Mussolini had it in Italy, and it's called fascism. It's where your big corporate interests throw in with government, destroy the freedom of the rest of the people, and preserve their power. Everybody forgets private corporations and banks did quite well, made out quite well in Italy and Germany in those days, you know? And I'm really worried about this assault on our democracy. The idea, we didn't cover insurance, as Sanders pointed out, insurance for 4 million kids, because Bush vetoed it and said $7 billion was too much to spend to cover insurance, health insurance for 4 million kids. But now they can throw $700 billion at these banks, and they say we can't even have hearings about it. It is absolutely outrageous, and I don't want to lose that point I made earlier. The best way to deal with this crisis now is to put a freeze on foreclosures. That's what the Democrats should be. It's what Hillary mentioned during the primaries. I don't know if she did it just as a one-liner, but the fact is it's a very reasonable thing to do. Say American homeowners should not suffer now. You know, if people were given these mortgages, and by the way, it's not just the subprime mortgage holders that hurt. If the housing market collapses as it has, it hurts everyone. Why not a freeze on foreclosures? And why are the Democrats not pushing that idea? Let's help out the people who are suffering, you know, and the working people, middle-class people, poor people who have these homes. It's their whole asset, instead of worrying about saving Goldman Sachs and saving Citigroup. And it's amazing to me that a guy like Paulson could have been head of Goldman Sachs. He knew this was all going on. Robert Rubin was head of Goldman Sachs. They go into the government, and now they're going to bail out their former companies, and we have to pay for it? I mean, it's outrageous.
Dean Baker, you're the head of Center for Economic and Policy Research. It's based in Washington, D.C. The climate right now, I mean, watching the Sunday talk shows, there was this clear sense that if this is not accomplished in the next few days, that, you know, it's like before the invasion of Iraq. We can be hit by a weapon of mass destruction, is basically the idea. And this is about not saving Wall Street, but saving the American people. That was the message that was put out immediately yesterday.
Well, I want to walk a line here. I mean, there is a point. The system of payments stopped working last week. If that happened, we would have to, like, go to buy our groceries with gold. We had a serious situation. Now, on the other hand, the Fed and Treasury were able to deal with it. They are able to deal with it. They have the resources to deal with that. But it is a very serious situation. So they aren't talking about total nonsense in that. Now, they're trying to scare Congress to death, because it's not as though we have to do it today or tomorrow. And, you know, what I would say is we do have to keep the system operating, but it should be
punitive. They're saying by Thursday or Friday.
Punitive.
They're saying by Thursday or Friday.
We could probably wait a week. We could probably wait 2 weeks. But the point is, it could be punitive. It should be punitive. That is the whole point. If UBS wants to come here and sell 90% of their company to us to sell their junk, fine. And their CEOs are going to get a 90% or 95% pay cut, fine. It's got to be punitive. I don't care if the whole world wants to sell their financial system to us. That's fine. We can structure this. We should structure it in a way that keeps the system operating and is punitive so that UBS is not happy to have to come here. That can be done, and that's what should be the focus. I should also say progressives have an unbelievable opportunity here. The people hate Wall Street now. They see that you have the highest paid people in the country that ruin their companies, ruin the economy, and now they're asking for a handout. We have a chance to turn around the inequality that's been built up over the last 30 years by hitting it right at the top if we focus in the right direction. We can do this. They have to have that bailout. They do need it. We have time, and we can impose the conditions that ensure that the people who got us here get punished.
On that note, I want to thank you both for being with us, of course, who will continue to cover this. Dean Baker with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, Robert Scheer, veteran journalist, columnist, editor at the political website truthdig.com. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, waiting for an ordinary day in Iraq, the unraveling of life there. Stay with us. People of Baghdad, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 700 stations, on Pacific and NPR and low-power FM and college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks. Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines are also available there in Spanish, in transcript and an audio form for any radio station to take. It's over 200 R. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Juan?
Well, it was the email read around the world. 4 years ago, in September 2004, Farnaz Fasihi, an Iranian-American correspondent in Iraq for the Wall Street Journal, sent a private email to family and friends that described the situation in Iraq more sincerely than her published newspaper articles ever could. She wrote, quote, "One could argue that Iraq is already lost beyond salvation. For those of us on the ground, it's hard to imagine what, if anything, could salvage it from its violent downward spiral. The genie of terrorism, chaos, and mayhem has been unleashed onto this country as a result of American mistakes, and it can't be put back into a bottle." The email somehow leaked out to fellow journalists and various bloggers who posted it on numerous websites, where it eventually gained a mass audience.
The email also revealed the perils of reporting from Iraq and how foreign correspondents in Baghdad were, quote, "under virtual house arrest." Fasihi wrote, quote, I avoid going to people's homes and never walk in the streets. I can't go grocery shopping anymore, can't eat in restaurants, can't strike a conversation with strangers, can't look for stories, can't drive in anything but a full armored car, can't go to scenes of breaking news stories, can't be stuck in traffic, can't speak English outside, can't take a road trip, can't say I'm an American, can't linger at checkpoints, can't be curious about what people are saying, doing, feeling, and can't. That was Farnaz Fasihi writing in 2004. Well, she's just published a book about what life was like in those years following the invasion. It's called Waiting for an Ordinary Day, The Unraveling of Life in Iraq. Farnaz Fasihi, welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
So you got there before Saddam Hussein fell.
Yes, the first time I went to Iraq was October 2002, when Saddam was still in power. And then subsequently in January of 2003, about 3.5 months before the U.S. invasion. So I got to see the before and after of Iraq, basically, before and after the war.
And talk about the spiral downward.
The spiral downward, in some sense, started right after the invasion, and it was partly because the Americans really didn't have a good post-invasion plan in place, a good political plan in place to bring all the different factions together, the Sunnis, the Shias, and the Kurds. And, you know, almost immediately, I remember right when Tikrit even fell, a few days after Baghdad fell, there was talks of insurgency, there was talks of jihad and of resisting the American occupiers. And slowly, this turned into an organized movement. And by early 2004, which was the first anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion, we just saw things just slipping down and security falling apart, car bombs everywhere, attacking international organizations like the U.N., like the Red Cross, hotels where journalists were staying, kidnappings, random violence and car bombs, and it was just impossible to contain. And that eventually led to civil war by 2006 because the cycle of violence just went on and on and on.
And the ability of you as a Western reporter, obviously, to do your job, and as you described so eloquently in those emails, to what degree were you able to actually even give a picture of what was happening?
You know, it really depended on the situation. Our security ebbed and flowed with the situation of Iraq. There were times where we just couldn't go anywhere, and we got creative with reporting, asking our Iraqi staff to go and bring Iraqis to the office or do the reporting for us. And there, you know, there were times where I wouldn't be able to leave the office or the hotel for a few weeks at a time. And there were times where I could go out, but it was always very security oriented. Everywhere we went, we had to stay for 20 minutes. And then rush back and have, you know, travel in an armored car and have bodyguards with you. So it definitely wasn't an ideal way of reporting by any means.
Describe to us ordinary life right after the invasion, which is what your power was.
Ordinary life was turned upside down immediately after the invasion. For starters, there was the fallout of security, a security vacuum created by the toppling of the regime. There were no police officers. There was no army, no Iraqi security forces, and a lot of looting and mayhem. It was almost as if just crazy people had taken over the streets. So people were terrified. They didn't know where to go if their car got stolen or if their house items got looted. There was power outage. There was sewage problems, clean water problems. People were getting killed randomly. So by no means of the imagination was anything normal.
Well, in Dexter Filkins of the New York Times, who also spent quite a bit of time in Iraq, wrote a piece in this Sunday's Times, actually, where he describes the enormous changes that have occurred in Iraq, that he was just shocked at how so much has returned to normal, quote, normalcy in the country. And obviously, he was tying it to the surge and, and the effect of the surge on everyday life of Iraqis. And what's your sense, then, with this more time has passed, of the American role in this occupation and its impact on the Iraqi people?
The American rule has really evolved in this war. You know, it was first that they went in to topple the regime and bring, you know, nation build a new nation and bring democracy and in place a government. And slowly it evolved into what is now, you know, the Americans basically acting as a buffer zone between the Sunnis and the Shias to prevent a civil war from happening. So the goals of this war and the responsibility of the troops really changed as security changed on the ground. You know, about whether life has returned, it's definitely gotten better, but what we have to realize is that extreme measures have been taken for life to somewhat return to normal. There are blast wall barriers around neighborhoods in Baghdad separating the Sunnis and the Shias. There's been a natural population movement where the city is ethnically divided along ethnic and sectarian lines.
The report that just came out of UCLA mm-hmm. saying that the fact that that things have somewhat calmed down mm-hmm. is not because of the surge, but because of ethnic cleansing.
I think that the fact that the violence came down is because of three reasons. It's because of the surge, one reason. It's also because of the Americans putting the Sunni insurgents on the payroll. They're paying about $300 a month to former insurgents who were killing the troops a few years ago because they're now trying to get on board with the American plan, and also because of the Shia ceasefire. But these things are very fragile. I mean, you know, it could one of you take one out of the equation and things could fall apart again. I think there was a report yesterday that assassination cells have returned to Baghdad, killing people. So,
why do you think your email was such a shock to people? There were reporters who were there. You were there yourself, mm-hmm. writing for a mainstream paper for the Wall Street Journal.
That's a good question, Amy. I've often thought about that. And I think it's probably because the email was personal and it didn't just pile facts on top of each other the way that we do when we're writing for the paper or for any media organizations. I think the fact that it had some emotion in it, that it kind of wasn't distant. You know, war is a very emotional, very traumatizing experience to both witness and go through. And I think I had sort of set aside those objective you know, standards of writing a piece and had really spoken from my heart. And I think that kind of grabbed people.
One group that's rarely talked about much in the war in Iraq are the children of Iraq.
Right.
What is your sense in terms of the everyday life of children in Iraq has been the immediate and obviously the long-term consequences to the Iraqi population of children exposed to so much trauma?
You know, I can give you an example and anecdotes of my book. There's a chapter that I talk to this family whose mother is Shia and father is Sunni, and they were having a really hard time with their children who were in elementary school. The first grader refused to go to school the first week because he was afraid that if he goes to school, something bad would happen to his mother or that he would die. When they asked him, "What should we tell the teacher?" he said, "Tell him that the insurgents kidnapped me." So this is the mindset of a seven-year-old child, that kidnapping and murder and assassination is just part of the vocabulary. You know, kids were getting teased because they were Sunni or they were Shia. They were dealing with very difficult issues like, you know, friends, parents getting killed or getting kidnapped. And I think it has really long-lasting effects. I mean, if you think that the next generation in Iraq has lived and grown up in war and mayhem, it's bound to have some deep psychological scars.
You've covered the Intifada, you've covered Iraq, you've covered Afghanistan. You're Iranian-American.
Yes.
You got your degrees from Tehran University and from Columbia Journalism School. What was it like covering Iraq as an Iranian-American?
You know, it was very interesting because I, you know, my memories of Iraq, my first time that I ever heard the word Iraq was when I was 8 years old and the war started with Iran and Iraq, and I was in Tehran and they were bombing the city and everyone said these are Iraqi warplanes. So for me to be on the other side of the border was, you know, very personal. But it was also, it gave me some insight because I knew the culture, I could relate to the people, and they kind of saw me as somebody who could maybe understand them better because I was from a country next door and could kind of have a better understanding of their traditions.
And we just have a few seconds, but you've also covered Afghanistan, and as we see the war in Afghanistan spiraling out of control now, your thoughts?
I think that that's something that needs to be paid attention to, because that's where the Al-Qaeda cells are located, and it's unfortunate that, you know, they couldn't finish what they had started in Afghanistan and bring some sort of a stability before going to Iraq. And I think, as we see now, there may be a redeployment of troops back to Afghanistan, but things are definitely deteriorating very fast there, and it's very, very dangerous.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Farnaz Fasihi has written the book Waiting for an Ordinary Day, The Unraveling of Life in Iraq. And that does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Berkshire, photo producer Aaron Matthew, Angela Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Honey Masood, Robbie Karen, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Peter Curries are our engineers. Thanks also to Becca Staley, Angie Kiefer, Samantha Chumbly, Jay Solnor, John Randolph, Kieran Krug Meadows, Rakan Penny, Vesta Godars. Our website is democracynow.org. And today I get to take off the arrest band from the Twin Cities Police. The police have dropped the charges against us at Democracy Now!, along, they say, with the other reporters that were covering the Republican National Convention. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.